Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, with all of us in lockdown, it's been a great time for getting things done that have been in the I just don't have enough time basket until now, isn't it? It might be one of the things that's been on your list for a while is exploring and learning a bit more about a concept called mindfulness. It's been talked about as a great way of dealing with stress and managing pain, and also as a way of making sure that you're present in each moment. It's quite a fashionable term, but I wonder what it actually means. Our regular Monday night guest, clinical psychologist Dr. Sarah Edelman, author of Change Your Thinking, is a great exponent of mindfulness. And she's here to explain, well, how you might figure out for you what it is, how you practice it, and how it might help you. Sarah, good evening, and welcome to Nightlife.
Hello, Philip, and hello to all your listeners.
Yes, well, no, hello to you too. It's funny, isn't it? We're all talking from our separate, you know,
yes.
Little separate locations.
Yeah, here I am at home, and I must say it's very comfortable not having to sort of drive into the ABC studio. And right. Apparently the sound's reasonably good, so
everything is dandy.
Makes me feel very good.
One of the great joys of radio, I think, always think is no matter where we are, anywhere around the country, you know, we're all listening together, and we may as well be in the same room because that's exactly what it sounds like.
Oh, that's good to know.
Now, what exactly is mindfulness anyway?
Well, it's a way of using our mind, and it's a way that we don't normally use our mind. And basically, two very simple concepts. One is being very present, paying attention to what is happening right now. So being aware of current experience right now. And the second thing is the attitude of not judging. So whatever it is that you notice, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, it's just observing with curiosity, with openness, and with acceptance.
Okay. I mentioned at the start it's become kind of fashionable to talk about it. Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Well, it's really been around for thousands of years. It's part of a Buddhist practice, and Buddha himself wrote a lot about the philosophy of mindfulness. But it's really in the late 1970s that it was popularized in the West, and there was a doctor at the University of Massachusetts, Jon Kabat-Zinn, who was given a number of patients with chronic pain and advanced diseases to try and treat and try and help, and they were emotionally distressed, they were physically dealing with lots of pain, and he applied the principles of mindfulness. He was practicing Buddha himself, and he developed a practice called mindfulness-based stress reduction, and he popularized that. He published some papers on it, and suddenly there was a huge amount of interest. And from that time, more and more researchers got curious, started doing randomized controlled trials, a number of studies, and now we've got hundreds, literally hundreds of different studies that have evaluated mindfulness in all sorts of different applications. And suddenly there was a huge amount of curiosity amongst psychologists and amongst mental health practitioners, and to the point that now it's become a very mainstay tool that we use in all sorts of psychological therapies.
Mm. I mean, it sounds extraordinarily simple to call it greater self-awareness.
Yes, but, it's
because it's a bit like saying, oh, well, all you have to do is be happy. I mean, this may be true, but of course, getting there in either case is
The practice is actually reasonably easy to describe, and there are different components of the practice, but it's not that hard to describe. The actual practice, particularly of meditation, is very challenging, and often when people sort of start off trying to do it, they're sort of enthusiastic for a short period of time, and then they just find that their mind is all over the place and it seems very hard to do, and a lot of people start and sort of give up very quickly because it just, you know, it seems much harder than I guess they'd planned for.
Why all this emphasis on paying attention to the present? How can that be helpful?
Well, the present moment is not a bad place to be most of the time, actually. If you think about if you take snapshots of your present moment from different times during the week. Just think of, you know, any random time, and you think of the present moment. Most of the time, what we're experiencing at that time is not necessarily bad or negative, but we may still be suffering, not because of what's happening in our present moment, but what's happening within our mind. And the problem is we are lost in the content of our own thoughts most of the time without even realizing that we're thinking. And when we look at the sort of the causes of suffering and the causes of distress, it's most of the time what is happening in thoughts rather than what's happening in the present moment. So just teaching people to be more aware of what's going on in the present moment helps them to also notice the, you know, the intrusions of thoughts, the influence of thoughts, and the role that thoughts play in determining our mood, our emotions, and how we're feeling much of the time. We are generally most happy when we are in the present moment, and conversely, when we are really happy, when we are really engaged with things, we are totally in the present moment. You think of some of your happiest times and you're present there. You know, if your mind is sort of thinking back to things that happened during the day, or you're ruminating, or you're sort of worrying about the future, no matter what's going on in your life, no matter how good your circumstances, you will not be happy because you're not present.
Yeah, it's a central component of some types of psychological treatments too, isn't it, mindfulness?
Yeah. Look, mindfulness has completely revolutionised psychology, in my view. You know, who would have, when I first started practising, the mainstay treatment was cognitive behaviour therapy, which still has, I think, enormous implications, applications, and is very useful. But the issue is sometimes upsetting emotions are normal, and we can't really sort of change it. Cognitive behavior therapy and a number of other therapies were all about sort of analyzing thoughts, or challenging thoughts, or changing thoughts, or trying to think in a different way. And along came this basic philosophy, which is thousands of years old, which is just observe your thoughts, just notice what's going on for you, and be curious. Don't judge. It's a completely different approach to what we were used to, and it's actually given us a great tool for extending the sort of things that we can do, extending methods for reducing suffering, for coping with depression, coping with anxiety. And you know, all the other tools that we've always had are still useful, but mindfulness has really added a whole new set of tools. It's also been adopted, you know, there's a number of therapies, what we call third wave therapies, that have sprung up since, you know, the late 1990s and, you know, in the early 2000s, including mindfulness-based cognitive therapy and a therapy called ACT, or acceptance and commitment therapy, dialectical behavior therapy, mindfulness-based stress reduction. All of these therapies are different branches of psychology that use mindfulness as a central tenet for helping people deal with emotional suffering.
Some describe it as mindfulness as basically sitting with your eyes closed, focusing on your breath. Is that a way to describe it?
Yeah, I mean, part of mindfulness is meditation. So there are different components of mindfulness, and one component is meditation, and that involves learning to just focus the mind by using the term that's often used is an anchor. An anchor is an object of focus that we keep coming back to, and the most widely used anchor is the breath. But you can also use sounds. You can focus on sounds that you can hear. You can focus on body sensations. You can focus on thoughts. You can just observing thoughts as an object of focus. You can focus on just scanning the body, scanning different parts of the body. The bottom line with meditation is that we are tuning into something very mundane, which sort of eliminates the normal, the scattered thoughts, the thoughts going from one thought to another, and just allows the mud to settle. It allows thoughts to settle. It gives us a little bit of clarity. It helps us to just, it trains our mind to just focus on one thing.
Yeah, what's the point though? I mean, why are we sitting on focusing on something mundane like breath or sounds?
Well, it sort of trains the mind to wander less. It trains us to actually switch off that sort of automatic, rumination, overthinking, overanalyzing, worrying, all that stuff that that normally goes on in our mind. And a lot of the stuff that goes on in our mind is not really productive thinking. It's not useful. It's not clarity. It's kind of overthinking. It's confused. It's scattered. So it helps us to just quieten the mind. Some have actually talked about, it's like the mad monkey, the monkey that jumps from tree to tree to tree, and we're sort of just trying to still the monkey in our mind, just get helping us to learn to focus on one thing at a time. Part of that is that it gives us greater insight into what's happening within us. And in addition to that, it also helps us to just focus and to concentrate and to stay present. So the meditation is the training, and it's in that returning back. So people are sort of sitting there trying to focus on their thoughts, and then they notice that their mind's wandered. And the real skill is recognizing, my mind's wandered, bring it back. And it's in that bringing it back, coming back to focusing on the breath or focusing on sounds, coming back to the anchor. It's through that process that the real training, that the mental muscle is being developed, and that we actually learn to be more present in the here and now.
You mentioned at the beginning of this conversation about Buddhist practice and underpinning much of it. Is that explain how that how that interacts with mindfulness?
Yeah, so it derives from Buddhism, and in fact, Buddhism was originally a really just a form of psychology, and it was about learning how to deal with suffering and to live more meaningful lives. And a key tenet of Buddhist psychology is that we spend our lives grasping at the pleasant and recoiling at the unpleasant. So we're sort of constantly sort of resistant to anything that's unpleasant. And it's through that process of constantly chasing what we consider as pleasant and running away from the unpleasant that we create suffering. So the philosophy is that instead of trying to push away or fight against or avoid unpleasant experience, that instead that we just learn to be curious, that we observe, that we watch things with a curious and open mind, and through experiencing, through looking at it in a different way, it changes the experience. It releases a lot of the suffering that we normally experience when we don't pursue pleasantness and push away unpleasant experience. Mm.
Yes, it's not just, is it, focusing on the breath? You can practice mindfulness by focusing on what's actually happening in daily life situations too, can't you?
Yeah, and this is the second component of mindfulness. It's the mindful awareness in daily life. And this is one of the real advantages of mindfulness and how it really differs from other forms of meditation. So there are many, many schools of meditation, and most of them involve focusing on one object or anchor. Whereas mindfulness also has that flexibility of being able to practice no matter what you're doing, whether you're putting out the garbage or waiting for the bus or on a walk or just doing your daily exercise, whatever it is that you're doing. You can become more aware of what is going on right now. So in that process, whatever it is that you're doing, you might be in the shower, just notice sensation, be present with what's happening for you right now. Notice the physical sensations, notice the sounds you can hear, notice what's going on inside of you, notice your mood, how you're feeling right now. Notice the thoughts that are sitting in the back of your mind. You know, there is so much going on for us at any given moment. So we use those times as opportunities to connect with what's going on for us right now.
Yes, some of us as kids may have been told, stop daydreaming and concentrate on what you're meant to be doing.
Yeah.
How does that fit
with
mindfulness?
You know, and daydreaming has its place as well, and even thinking about the future has its place, and thinking about the past has its place. I think the problem is when we spend so little of our time in the present moment, when our thoughts are so frequently occupied by things that have happened in the past, or things that, you know, that we're concerned about in the future. And through those processes, we may create depression, we may create anger, we may create frustration, we may create anxiety and fear about the future. So actually recognizing that most of that suffering is actually coming from things that are going on in our mind, and they are things that are about being detached from the present moment.
Mm.
You know, daydreaming may be useful at times. All sorts of thinking is useful at times. It's what we spend our time on much of the time that matters.
See, some might say, well, no, Sarah, when I'm in the shower in the morning before work, I'm thinking about, you know, the series of meetings I've got to go to, and what, mm-hmm. and the presentations I've got to give. I'm rehearsing some of those in my mind. I'm going through. I'm trying to remember what else I had to bring. Do I need to bring those reports? And if I'm a parent, I'm thinking, is it a sport practice today? Have they packed their swimming togs? And so on. In other words, there's 1,000 things that are running through my head that, in a way, also require my attention.
Well, the question I would ask you is, are you actually planning? Is this productive thinking, or is this just, scattered thinking, overthinking, unhelpful thinking? Because you're absolutely right. There are times when it's totally appropriate to think about, to plan the day, to think about, you know, to perhaps even write a to-do list of all the things that you need to do. It may be really helpful to, you know, to scan some of the things that you've got planned for the day, and that can all be useful and worthwhile. We don't need to be in a mindful place, you know, 24 hours a day. It's about just being able to stop and pause and come back and notice what's happening in the present at various times. It's also asking yourself the question, is this just overthinking, unhelpful thinking? Is my mind sort of overloaded with all the to-dos that I've got vaguely feel I have to get through today? Or is this productive? Am I problem solving? If I'm concerned about an issue and it's causing me some emotional distress, am I actually problem solving? Am I thinking about solutions, or am I just ruminating?
Hmm.
And the beauty with mindfulness is that you start to notice rumination while you're doing it.
Yes, my texter says, Phil, if one feels safe for oneself and for one's others, then all is fine. But when the immediate future is indeterminable, it's normal to feel stressed. Otherwise, we wouldn't then be able to take action to remedy the situation.
Yes, and that's true. And emotions have a really important evolutionary function. And upsetting emotions in particular have great value, and that is that they motivate us to act. And fear is highly motivational. You know, it motivates us to seek out safety or to think about safety. Anxiety is anticipation of future negative things that could happen, and anxiety also motivates us to think about how we can protect ourselves in the future. So if we're in a situation where problem solving may be appropriate, or if we have, you know, if we have some idea about likely circumstances that we may find ourselves in, and we can problem solve, that may be useful to, you know, to think about it, to talk about it, to reflect on it, even to brainstorm. I think if we are just kind of worrying and overthinking and going from one what if to another, when the situation is out of control, is beyond our control, and it's really just about uncertainty about the future, that sort of worrying is usually not helpful. It keeps us in a very tense, aroused, uncomfortable place. It keeps us disconnected from the present moment. And it's actually not productive or helpful worry. So one of the questions I often get people to ask themselves when they're worrying is, you know, is this productive? Am I problem solving, Or am I just worrying? Am I just overthinking?
I think we'd all agree. Mm. I think we'd all connect with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm chatting with Dr. Sarah Edelman, clinical psychologist, and we're talking about mindfulness. Some people have tried meditation. I'm one of them too, but find it almost impossible. Are there some people who are just better at this than others?
Look, I think your emotional state has a really important impact on your ability to meditate. So if, for example, you're feeling anxious, your mind will always prioritize threat. So you're much more likely to be sort of, your mind will be sort of drawn to all sorts of other things. It's hard to be in the present when you're anxious. If you've got lots of to-dos in the back of your mind, for people who are really busy, it is really difficult very often, because the mind is sort of constantly going to all the to-dos, all the things that need to be done. I sometimes recommend that people write a list of their to-dos before they do meditation, because quite often if all those things that you need to do are sort of there in the background, it's really hard to sort of stay present. Some people just have very short attention spans. There are a number of people that have attention deficit disorder, or it may not be, a diagnosed condition, but they just find it very hard to pay attention for long periods of time, and that makes it difficult as well. What is probably helpful in that situation, if you find it hard, always say just short, frequent bursts, and even just setting your phone to just remind you, to give you a little reminder, and to take 1 minute to pause. So even if you don't do a formal meditation, to pause, close your eyes, and ask yourself the question, what's going on for me right now? And if you close your eyes and ask yourself that question and just stop and observe, you will, particularly if you practice a bit of mindfulness, you will notice physical sensations, you will notice thoughts sitting in the back of your mind, you will notice your mood, whether you feel good or bad or neutral, you will notice possibly the presence of tension, possibly the presence of anxiety, possibly sort of concerns in different parts of your mind. We are a massive sensation and a massive experience, and most of the time we are disconnected from it. So even taking, a couple of times a day where you take 1 minute to just stop and observe is a useful way of becoming mindful without necessarily going through that whole process of the meditation.
I mean, one of the things you're saying here is that you shouldn't push aside the to-do list. You need to acknowledge that.
Yeah, well, if you try and push aside, a lot of our urges and our mental habits are sort of, are helpful. We need to plan our days, and so instinctively we have an urge to sort of plan that day. If we try and push it away, it's going to constantly sort of come back to us. And part of the reason why all our to-dos seem to come up when we're trying to meditate is because our mind is trying to keep them in our consciousness. At some level, perhaps it sort of feels like it'll be forgotten unless we keep it in our consciousness. And therefore, just thinking about your to-dos, writing them down, having them on paper, means that you don't have to think about them. Now they're in hand, and you will address them. You'll go to that piece of paper once you finish the meditation. And for many people, that is a good way of just letting go of all of those to-dos that would otherwise be coming up during the meditation itself.
Sometimes people wake up feeling depressed. In fact, a lot of people do. How can practicing mindfulness prevent that from turning into a full-blown depression for the day?
Yeah, sometimes they may wake up feeling depressed. Sometimes we experience transient depressed mood. So, in fact, most of us experience that at various stages. And I guess during this whole period of physical distancing and all the restrictions that we've got and changes in work practices and so on, most people would at times sort of feel a bit sad or down. The problem is when, and again, this is that whole issue of judgment, you feel low And instinctively, you start to feel low about feeling low. Most people are not aware that they are judging their current experience, including their current emotional experience. So what often could be just a transient experience, and again, if you have mindful awareness, you may say, or you may notice, I notice that at the moment my mood is low. I notice that right now I'm feeling sad. If you're not mindful, you may just automatically start ruminating, and one of the downsides of having low mood is that your thinking becomes more negative anyway, and then you start engaging with that thinking, you start ruminating, you start seeing things more and more negatively, and then it can snowball into a more sort of permanent or a longer depressed state, or sometimes even into a clinical depression. And in fact, one of the some of the best studies in terms of the efficacy of mindfulness, and this was done with mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, involved teaching people who have recurrent depression that when they have that low mood, to observe it with a completely open and accepting mind. In other words, you don't judge, you observe, you acknowledge, you notice what's happening, but you don't immediately start ruminating. And so typically what happens is people start ruminating when they experience that low mood, and it kind of just pushes them back into another relapse into depression. And what they found with this research, and it's been done a couple of times and they've had really good, consistent, robust findings, is that when people learned how to use mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, they reduced their rate of relapse, or they significantly reduced the likelihood of relapse. So just allowing that low mood to be, observing it, labeling, noticing the negative thoughts that low mood will generate, because low mood will generate negative thoughts. Observe, be present, let it happen.
Mm. My guest is clinical psychologist Dr. Sarah Edelman. We're talking about mindfulness. What about mindfulness of thoughts? How can that be helpful?
Yeah, so we are, our mind is thinking all the time, and in fact, much of the time we are ruminating. And ruminating is just going around in circles, going from one negative thought to another to another. Often we're ruminating about negative things that have happened, or things from our past, things that could happen. And sometimes, you know, we're worrying and we're overthinking things, overanalyzing things, and much of the time that's happening without any awareness. So mindfulness of thoughts involves just observing what is going on in our minds right now, and being able to label those thoughts, being able to pause and say, oh, I notice that I'm having these negative thoughts right now. I notice that right now my thoughts are scattered. I'm totally not present. And again, take the time to pause. You know, just pause whatever you're doing, stop, close your eyes, notice what's going on. You can do a mindfulness meditation which just focuses on thoughts. I think Eckhart Tolle talked about being like a cat at a mouse hole, watching your thoughts. It's almost like just observe anything that pops into your mind. Just notice where your mind goes, notice what the thoughts are. And that in itself is almost like a form of meditation, where you use your own mind as an object of focus and curiosity.
So in a way, if you're just being mindful about thoughts, it would also be helpful in realizing that negative thoughts are just that too.
Are just thoughts, yes. Just thoughts. Yeah. Mm. It creates a distance from them. Normally, we are totally 100% engaged in thoughts. You have a thought, it's your reality. You may have a whole stream, and if you're experiencing emotions, you'll have whole streams of thoughts. You'll have a whole lot of consistent thoughts. Often they'll be negative thoughts if you're experiencing negative emotions, but they are reality. You know, you, as far as you're concerned, they are just truth. The beauty of mindfulness of thoughts is that it separates you a little bit. It gives you a little bit of distance. It gives you the capacity to say, isn't that interesting what my mind is producing right now? Oh, I notice I've just had another worry thought. Oh, that was another one. Look at how negative this thought is. So it's in that ability to step back and watch your own thinking that you create distance from your thoughts. You actually recognize this is just a thought, as opposed to this is reality.
Mm. What about anxiety? How can mindfulness help people reduce anxiety?
Well, there are a number of ways. One is the meditation itself. So for people who've had lots of practice with meditation, when they go, even if they're in a very anxious state, when they turn their attention to their breathing, and it's most often their breath, and just focus on their anchor, their anxiety, their attention to threat, which is normally sort of sitting in other parts of their mind, just sort of switches off. And as a result of that, just focusing on that anchor helps to reduce anxiety. The other thing is that just recognizing that anxiety itself is creating catastrophic thoughts. So if we sort of understand that relationship, that anxiety produces catastrophic thoughts, I mean, catastrophic thoughts feed anxiety, but the key thing is anxiety produces catastrophic thoughts. And once we start noticing and separating those catastrophic thoughts, that in itself helps to reduce anxiety. And then finally, the actual feeling of anxiety itself. So anxiety feels unpleasant. Most of us hate anxiety. We sort of really desperately try and sort of resist it, and we want to push it away. And the problem is, the more we kind of try and fight anxiety, the more of a threat it becomes. So once again, just learning to observe with curiosity, without judgment, just allowing ourselves to kind of notice what we're experiencing during the anxiety, paradoxically reduces the intensity of anxiety much of the time.
Let's take a call or two. DJ's on the line. DJ, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife. Hi, DJ.
Hi, guys. How are we going?
Hi, DJ.
I've been suffering for 36 years from clinical depression.
Mm-hmm.
And I notice it creeps back in, and I've actually tried to manage it. But you tonight have explaining it a lot better than I've ever had it explained to me. And I'm starting to understand that what I should be doing rather than what I have been doing. I get a lot of thoughts creeping into my mind all the time, every day, and I've lost a lot of relationships and businesses over the years through these things destroying my life, really. So I just don't know. I feel it creeping into me from time to time, and I think I'm fighting it, but then I just lapse back in, and I'll go for 2 or 3 days, and I'm just shut down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, look, I'm going to suggest a couple of things. First of all, and this is for all listeners who are interested in learning mindfulness. At the moment, and this is, I think, during the coronavirus period, there is a meditation program online which is free. They normally charge for it. And it's, if you Google 40-day mindfulness challenge, these are two of the top experts in mindfulness, and it's 40 mindfulness exercises, and they are excellent because they actually explain the process. And I think the problem with mindfulness is that most people sit there trying to focus on their breath, find their mind is wandering all over the place, get really frustrated, give up on it, and or just feel like they're failures because they can't do it. And the beauty of this program is, A, it really explains it well. And it explains the philosophy and what you're trying to do and what your aims are. And they're reasonably short. They're about 10 minutes, which I think is doable for most people, so they can actually get you into the habit. So once again, Google 40-day mindfulness challenge, the number 40.
I've just written that down. Yeah.
Yeah. The other one that is excellent and is free is if you Google This Way Up. And This Way Up is an Australian program. They actually have a number of programs for managing depression, anxiety, and various mental health issues. Normally, they charge $60 a program. For the month of April, it's all their programs are free, so you can enroll in their programs free of charge. But they also have a mindfulness meditation program, which I think is free all the time. So I would, if you know, I'd get on to them because they also have an excellent program for depression as well. And it's self-help online and it's animated and it's got very good, you know, very good components of
I've
it.
I've been a four psychologists over the years, and the last one mentioned mindfulness but didn't go deeply into it, so I didn't really understand.
Mm, okay.
And when you put this issue is put to you and then you walk out of the office, you don't really explore it because it's not foremost in your mind, and then you just go back to your normal life, and then it just creeps in. And traumatic experiences from the past.
That I mean, life can be so tough, can't it, when you have a difficult start early in life, and you know, then
thanks, DJ. There's a couple of things.
Thank you. And you're all the best.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Paul, hello.
Hi there. How are you?
Well, thank you.
That's good. Just a question to the doctor. Thank you again.
Mm-hmm.
And
pleasure.
Just reiterating what the last caller said, that you have put a couple of positive ideas into my head. It's not my wife. It's not myself, actually. It's my wife that's suffering with depression. And a little bit hard, and I'm learning bit by bit of how to, as a partner, cope with living with someone with depression. There's never been anything harder in my life. And we've been with each other since we were 16 years old, and we're now 59. The demons that are in the head are very scary for a partner who isn't experiencing that and tries to understand the ways how to help their partner. And I was just wondering, is it clearer for the person with depression once the medication, my wife is getting medication now, kicks in, and they can start to see different things maybe clearer, or isn't that the case with the medication?
Yeah, look, it depends whether they respond to the medication. So it depends on the type of depression and also the type of medication and the person, how well suited they are to that type of medication. So if they do respond, the problem is when you're in a depressed state, your thoughts are very negative. You have pessimistic thoughts. You have this global pessimism. It's very hard to see things objectively. So depression, it's a very physical condition. It's not just a mind thing. It just affects your whole body, and it affects the way that you think. So when you're in a depressed state, it's very hard to see things objectively. Once you start coming out of it, so if the depression is effective, and it is in about two-thirds of cases, depression is helpful for about two-thirds of people, the person starts to see things in a much more clear and a rational way, and in a more healthy, balanced way. And you know, hopefully by that stage, you know, it may also be easier for her to sort of perhaps consider something like learning meditation and learning to use her mind differently.
Yeah, look, it's so hard to try and be supportive as well as not going to the state of being over controlling, that you want to know why they're not self-helping to get any better. It's such a balance for the partner to try and be able to be there for them and try to, you know, get them going without seeming to wanting to control them to get them going, you know. And
It is so hard to relate to, Paul, when you're not experiencing it yourself, because you know there's a lot of irrationality. There's a lot of, you know, like why don't you just, you know, whatever. And if you haven't had that experience yourself, it is really hard to understand, you know how the person feels and why they think the way they do, etc. And it can be very stressful. I mean, you raise a really important issue, and that's for loved ones. It can be really painful to have to observe that.
So painful. I even had to learn that coming home from work and asking, "Hi, Dal, how was your day?" was offensive to her. Because I was challenging to say, well, what did you do today? You know, and if she didn't do anything, it was sort of invading on her to have to, you know, sort of justify what she did in the day that was positive. So now I've learnt not to say, you know, hey Dale, how was your day? Just to go, hi, you know, and not mention anything to do with, you know, what the activity was for the day, because some days it's nothing.
Really
tragic. You learn and you try to move on, and hopefully, it all gets better one day, and everyone wakes up and the demons are gone.
Yeah, let's hope. Paul, thank you.
You're right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for sharing with us as well. Yeah, it's tough. By the way, Anne from Ipswich has just texted Sarah saying, you mentioned the 40-day mindfulness challenge.
Mm-hmm.
She's saying, I get several returns on Google search for the mindfulness challenge.
What does she mean by returns?
I think she's getting several possibilities. In other words, the mindfulness challenge throws up more than one site.
More information, please.
Yeah. Author,
yes.
Perhaps.
Jack Cornfield. Okay. So add to that Jack Cornfield, Jack K-O-R-N Field, F-I-E-L-D, and Tara Brack, Tara, T-A-R-A, Brack, B-R-A-C-H.
B-R-A-C-H.
So if you combine those, you'll definitely get onto the site. And it'll say register here for the free, current free course. So you need to, you know, put in your, you know, your register and a password and so on.
Okay. I hope that helps, Anne. What about mindful eating? Sarah, can mindfulness help people improve their eating habits?
It's actually been used quite a lot. There's evidence that it actually helps, particularly for people with obesity or who are significantly overweight. And the issue with mindfulness is that you switch your attention internally. So you pay attention, and with mindful eating, you pay attention to internal cues, what's going on inside of your body. So you notice things like urges and tension and that drive to eat and the arousal that you sometimes feel when you're sort of perhaps emotionally affected and you sort of feel the urge to sort of go for food. So it enables you to slow down. The other thing that you know, one of the exercises that's done with mindful eating is you learn to eat more slowly. People who have done introductory mindfulness courses have often done the raisin exercise, and that involves just taking one raisin, you know, initially looking at it, smelling it, putting it between your lips, putting it on your tongue, feeling the texture, and then biting into it. And it is absolutely mind-blowing. I've done this on about three different occasions, and even though I know what to expect, I still find it mind-blowing. You get this explosion of flavour from one lousy raisin.
Does that make you get back into the rest of the box? Quick smart.
No. It actually really gets you to savour. You really realise how much you're missing, because most of the time we woof down our food and we sort of pay very little attention to our food. You know, or we might be reading or watching the TV or on, you know, looking at social media or whatever while we're eating. So, you know, the real thing, the real joy of food, slowing down, you know, savouring it, feeling the texture, chewing it, enjoying the flavours, and just sort of going through that slower process. And what people find is if they do that more slowly, first of all, you can notice when you really are hungry, and the difference between genuine hunger and just, say, emotional eating. You know, sometimes just slowing down and asking yourself, what is it that I need right now? And you realise what you need to do is relax your body, because you're very tense and you're sort of feeling this craving for something to give you immediate relief. So finding out what your real needs are, and if you are eating, just eating more slowly and with more with more joy and more awareness.
Another thing that mindfulness is often touted as being very useful for is helping people with their sleep. And gee, sleeplessness and getting to sleep and staying asleep is a big thing for a lot of people, isn't it?
Well, for many people, when they're not sleeping, they have two problems. They think they have one, but they actually have two. They have the fact that they're awake when they would like to be asleep. And the second problem is frustration or anxiety or worry. and a whole lot of thoughts about how terrible I'm going to feel tomorrow. I'm going to be tired all day. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be awful. Why can't I sleep now? And all that psychological stuff that accompanies the experience of not sleeping. Now, if you just had the experience of not sleeping without all that emotional stuff and without all those thoughts about it, then the chances are you would actually fall asleep a lot faster than if you, you know, than when you sort of got all that emotional stuff, baggage sort of accompanying it. And even if you didn't fall asleep any faster, you would still be suffering a lot less. You know, the suffering is coming mainly from all the negative thoughts and the anxiety and the frustration and all the negative emotions that accompany not sleeping. So once again, it's that learning not to judge, noticing, allowing yourself to experience whatever is experiencing and not judging. And once again, we find that when people learn not to judge, they fall asleep a lot faster than when they, you know, they sit there fretting, lie there fretting. Yeah,
exactly. Beth, hello.
Oh, is that me?
Yes, hi, Beth.
Oh, hi, Beth.
Sorry. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, sorry, I've sort of come in halfway through. My question is just in regards to basically, my team at work, I'm a chef, and to help with social distancing, we divided our team into Team A and Team B. And there's been a lot of stress and, you know, it's all a bit different, but I'm finding some of my staff members in Team A are being really negative and, you know, trying to, sort of feeling like they're being let down by Team B over, like, handovers and things like that. And I'm finding it difficult to get them to try and empathise that, you know, the other team is doing everything that they can. And do you know what I mean? It's just how do I
so,
get them
so it's
to,
frustrating or, for you. I guess this is really more about problem solving. It sounds to me like you need to sort of work out some way of building. Do people ever have time to sort of socialize or to, you know, to talk to each other beyond just the, sort of the rushing around and, you know, what we normally see when we see chefs working?
Yeah, within our teams, absolutely. And I think that's one of the key problems is that we haven't got any ability to really socialise with the other half that works the days that we don't.
Because of the distancing rules that you've got going.
Absolutely. So, you know, we work 3 days, they work 4 days, and then we switch rotation. But it's more, I just think that they're really, particularly in my team, they're very frustrated and their outlet is to basically have a bit of a whinge, and everyone needs that sometimes, and I accept that, and, you know, sometimes I'll just listen and the other times I'll actively try and fix the problem if it's actually a problem that needs fixing. But today particularly, I found it just completely overwhelming, and I just want to be able to go to them and give them the right tools or the right suggestions for them to be able to, like as you were saying, really think about, you know, is this a negative thought, is this But something that can be relatively
I mean, one of the things that I often remind people is, does thinking this way help me to achieve my goals? You know, what are my goals here? Yeah. What are my goals today? You know, it's to get through the work, to, you know, to do a good job, to get on with everybody else, to enjoy what I'm doing. Okay, does bitching about, you know, this other team B, does that help me to achieve my goals or is it counterproductive to my goals? So that's basic cognitive therapy, not necessarily mindfulness, but that may be helpful.
What I think I'm really trying to do is trying to instill a little bit of empathy so they understand that it's not something that's happening maliciously from the other team. It's just they didn't see whatever it was as, you know, we weren't there to see what was going on. So maybe, you know, you triage what you need to do during the day. That didn't fall, you know, at top of the list that day. So I think that's
so
really what
having,
I want to do.
Having a conversation and trying to elicit empathy is always a good thing. I mean, it's hard because they're not actually spending time together. If they were spending time together, you can actually do all sorts of things to kind of bond them as one team. But because they're separate,
it's not really been an issue previously, but that's you know, that's why I'm sort of pulling my hair out. But thank you so much.
Thanks, Beth. Bye. Yeah. All right. Well, gee, time's flown, hasn't it? We were going to talk about mindfulness for pain management. Just briefly, focusing on the pain, is that a good idea or not?
Well, look, the pain is, you know, most people's experience of pain is, once again, psychological factors play a role. So we have a physical sensation, an unpleasant physical sensation, but we also have an emotional reaction to that physical sensation. And usually it's distress, it's anxiety, it's frustration, sometimes feelings of, you know, of sadness and hopelessness. And once again, mindfulness, by teaching people to release the judgment. And it sounds sort of counterintuitive, but just learning to let it be, release the judgment, actually reduces suffering. And we find that mindfulness is at the core of most pain management programs that are being run in, you know, in all most of the major hospitals. It's about learning to partly to relax, but also to release judgment, to you know, to mindfully accept, and to you know, and then to gradually turn focus to other things. And in doing that, it can actually have a really significant effect on reducing pain.
Yep. All right. Well, guided practice is the best way to learn mindfulness, but there are a lot of free guided meditations, information available online, as you mentioned. You mentioned the This Way Up mindfulness course.
Yep, This Way
And
Up is probably the most This Way Up and the 40-day mindfulness
mindfulness
challenge are
challenge.
both accessible. This Way Up, I think, is free all the time. The other one is free, I think during the coronavirus period, but that
Okay.
hopefully will still
Yeah.
be for a
All
while.
right. All right. And yes, put Jack Kornfield or Tara
Tara
Brack,
Brack,
Brack.
yeah.
Okay. All right. Sarah, terrific as always. Thank you.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.